The Immortal Game, episode number 13.
The Immortal Game is a San Francisco Chronicle Book of the Year and is available in ebook and trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Hear more at patreon.com/markcoggins or author website markcoggins.com.
Chapter 23, Honest Dale's Used Cars. Bonnaker was talking on the phone when I walked in. He was dressed casually in a faded polo shirt with the logo of his insurance company over the pocket and a pair of khaki pants. He gave me an energetic military salute as I walked by, and I heard him say into the phone, "So the hippie takes off his mask and says, 'Surprise, I'm the hippie.' Then the nun takes off her mask and says, 'Surprise, I'm the bus driver.'" He guffawed. "I'm the bus driver," he repeated gleefully. "Get it?" I walked past Gretchen's desk, which was unoccupied, and into my office. On my desk was a bud vase with a single pink rose. Beneath the vase was a handwritten note from Gretchen. It read, "Augie, if you can't have rosy cheeks, then how about a plain old-fashioned rose? And I don't want to hear any complaints about women giving men flowers. Didn't anyone ever tell you not to look a gift bud in the pistol?" I told Ben I was taking the rest of the day off. Time for a little retail therapy. But I did check into the things you requested. Here's the scoop. You're on for the gig at Anducci this evening. Tony wants everyone there by 6:30. You're supposed to play 4 sets, and he expects you'll be out of there by 1 or so. Todd Nagel's landlord has no forwarding address for him. He says Nagel was a good tenant and always paid his rent on time. However, Nagel only gave him a few days' notice before he moved out. I checked through the phone numbers on the bill you gave me. Most of them were pretty innocuous, if you think $200 worth of 1-900 phone sex numbers is innocuous. But it does appear that Mr. Nagel called Terry McCullough's home number several times. He also made a lot of calls to a number with a Woodside prefix, not Bishop's, that I can't track down. It never picks up when I call, and it's not shown in any of the reverse directories we have. Maybe you have some other tricks up your sleeve. Take care of yourself. XOXO, Gretchen. It occurred to me, not for the first time, that Gretchen was better than I deserved. I picked up Nagel's phone bill from the desk where Gretchen had left it and glanced at the number she had highlighted. It had an 851 prefix like Bishop's, but apart from that, there was nothing familiar about it. I folded up the bill and put it in my breast pocket with the intention of getting Stockwell to use his official connections on it. Then I pulled out the yellow pages to refresh my memory on the address that went with the phone number and place of business I'd seen earlier today on a business card. Chuck Haystrom's friend Dale was running a nice half-page ad to remind me that Pace Auto Sales and Brokerage was located on Market Street, just east of Laguna. I jotted down the street number and went out of the office. Bonnaker was still talking on the phone as I walked by. There was a concerned look on his face. He said, "Hey, come on, I'm Catholic myself. I went to St. Ignatius and was taught by the sisters and everything. There's no reason to cancel your insurance policy over a little joke. As a matter of fact, my good friend Father Murphy told it to me in the first..." "Hello? Hello?" I jumped on the number 8 bus, just outside the building, and rode it straight down Market to Laguna. Dale Pace's used car emporium was on a narrow lot that ran under an elevated portion of Highway 101. There was a Quonset hut at one end for washing and prepping the cars, and a trailer on a raised platform at the back that housed the office. A tattered line of plastic flags was strung from the trailer to the hut, like colored pennants on a sinking yacht. There were about 3 dozen cars for sale, all of them 5 or more years old, and none of them costing much over $6,000. It looked like the kind of place you bought your car if you were on your way up in the world, or you were well on your way down. The oppressive rumble of freeway traffic fell on me like a weighted net as I came onto the property. To my extreme right was a young couple eyeing a middle-aged Toyota with skepticism. In front of them stood a glib-looking man in a checkered sport coat and a black turtleneck. He had bushy black hair, a black mustache, and he smiled a lot, and he made tight gestures with his fingers extended as if he was coiling yarn. I left them to the rituals and made a beeline for the door of the trailer. Inside there was a lot of dust, linoleum, low-wattage lighting, and a couple of desks. Behind one of these sat Dale Pace. He glanced up as I walked in and immediately jerked open a drawer and began groping for something at the back. I pulled open my jacket with my left hand and wrapped my right around the exposed butt of the Glock automatic. "It doesn't have to be this way," I said. "But if you insist on swapping lead, you're going to be doing a lot more catching than throwing." He looked at me impassively and slumped back into his chair, his hands folded on his lap. "If you think I'm going to hold still for more of that crazy shit you pulled on Chuck, best you take your piece all the way out and see can you find the trigger." I let my arms go back to my side and walked deliberately over to Pace's desk. There were several pictures of him in a Steelers uniform on the wall behind, and a game ball resting on a stand on the bookshelf to one side. Pace was in shirt sleeves and a tie, and from the junk on top of his desk, appeared to have been working on the company books. I sat down in a chair by the desk. "I came to talk," I said. "That's all."
"That ain't necessarily better," he said, "because I don't have a whole heck of a lot to say to you. Unless you are in the market for a car, that is."
"No, no cars. I took the bus today. Viva public transportation and all that. Have the cops been here yet?" Pace took his time with that one.
"So you filed a complaint, did you? Seems to me what you did to Chuck pretty much evened things out. Or did you figure you still owed me?"
"I owe both of you plenty more as far as I'm concerned. But Chuck has put himself in a position where he's no longer eligible to receive payment. He committed suicide this morning. Blew his brains out at a shooting range in South San Francisco." Pace brought a finger up to his mouth and bit off a hangnail. He turned his head and spat out the harvest. "You'll have to excuse me," I said. "I'm not used to coping with such a display of unvarnished grief."
"I'd be an idiot to take your word for it," said Pace. "But if it is true, then it don't surprise me in the least. He was heading for a fall, no question."
"Why?"
"'Cause he got himself wrapped up with that bitch. She manipulated him all to hell. Had him run interference for her. Had him drop the hammer on you and all sorts of other shit he never would have got involved with on his own. He thought it was true love. She thought it was a convenient way to scrape the mud off her shoes."
"But that doesn't explain why he killed himself. Not really. Did McCullough dump him?" Pace shook his head.
"No. I mean, I don't know, man. Hard to dump someone exactly when you're hiding out from the cops. He must have got fed up with it all. He must have finally seen for himself what she was doing to him. Took a look in the mirror one day and didn't like the thing staring back at him."
"I don't believe it. There's got to be something else. Drugs, financial problems, culpability for a big crime, something." Pace cracked the knuckles on his huge hands absently.
"Hey, it don't make a never no mind to me what you think. I'm not even sure I believe he's dead. I'm just telling you it wouldn't surprise me."
"Did he shoot Roland Teller? Could that be what was eating him?"
"No, he did not shoot Teller. I think you've got a wrong idea about Chuck Haystrup. He isn't, or wasn't, the killer type. He could be mean, sure. You can't play defensive lineman in the NFL and not get a little mean. But on his own, he was basically a pretty good Joe. He used to do volunteer work for the Big Brothers. Donate blood, all sorts of do-gooder crap. Then he met her. She warped him something terrible, but not enough to kill."
"So what's your excuse?"
Pace smiled broadly. "Oh, I'm naturally bad. No one's fault but my own. If I'd been working you over that night, you would still be in the hospital counting doctors' fingers, as in, how many am I holding up now, Mr. Reardon? But when I do shit, I do it for me. I don't do it because some bitch squeezes my dick and pats me on the head."
"You helped Haystrup that night. That wasn't for you."
"That's different. I used to play ball with him, and you had already knocked him around pretty good earlier in the day. I didn't want him getting busted up anymore."
I should have let it go, but I said, "For somebody who's so all-fired eager to protect him, you sure don't seem very upset now to hear that he's dead."
Pace went rigid in his chair. He seemed to grow larger. "I already told you. I don't necessarily believe word one that you say. And if you expect me to start bawling or some shit like that if you come waltzing in here with a loaded gun, you got another thing coming. I'd written Chuck off anyway. That McCullough bitch took away his manhood.
That was almost exactly what Terry McCullough said Bishop had credited her with. If that's the case, I said, why don't you tell me where she is?
And why don't you fly around the room with jet farts out of your ass? Pace laughed. I can't, is why. Chuck never told me, and I never asked. Truth be known, I don't think McCullough even told him where she was.
But she did call him after the murder.
So he said. Look, it's not like I've been living with the guy. He called me once after you did your thing on him with a nail gun to give me the heads up. He said he talked to the bitch, and he started to lay on the sob stuff about what a shitty deal she got. But I told him to can it. I didn't want to listen to that load of boo-hoo.
I picked up a rubber band from Pace's desk and began twanging it like a bass string. I let my eyes wander up to the pictures of him in the uniform. I remember you now from the Steelers, I said. You were a heck of a linebacker. Pace grunted noncommittally, but I could tell he was pleased.
Well, them days are long gone. I wished I had a tenth of the money I made back then. I wouldn't be sitting in a trailer on a used car lot talking to you. But the coke and the women bled me white, so to speak. That's why I don't have much patience for Chuck. He's too old to be making those kind of mistakes with his life.
Pace looked down at his lap and seemed to go away for a moment.
You giving me the bona fides on this thing with Chuck? About him killing himself?
It's true. You'll probably be having a visit from a cop named Stockwell as soon as he can line up some cooperation from the SFPD. Then, to explain the connection, they found your card in his wallet.
So you're not filing charges on the shit that went down outside in the key of G?
No. There'd be a list of about 20 guys ahead of you if I started filing charges on everyone I tangled with. Stockwell's an EPA cop anyway. It wouldn't do any good to take it to him.
Well, I'm not sorry we racked you up. That was just the way it was. But I am sorry I smashed your bass. I snuck into the club while we were waiting and I heard you play. You weren't half bad, for a white boy.
Thanks. Crawford is the one with the juice in that band, though. While we're talking about the club, mind if I ask you one more question? Then I'll get out of your hair.
Pace rubbed his shaved head. Lucky I'm not a sensitive person, or I might have taken that for a crack. Go ahead. Ask your question.
There was a girl at the club that night named Jody. She works for Edwin Bishop like Terry McCullough used to. Do you know where she stands in all this? Did she have anything to do with you guys finding me at In the Key of G?
You must be the kind of guy that asked for double bags at the grocery store, Reardon. Chuck told me you wanted to know about her. All I can tell you is she's a friend of Terry's, and Chuck said that she and Terry weren't getting on so well since Terry had left Bishop. But she didn't have nothing to do with us being at the club. We tailed you there from your apartment.
I started to say something, and Pace raised his hand.
And don't ask me about that other dude you mentioned to Chuck, because I don't know nothing about him neither.
Nagel's his name. But that's not what I was going to ask. I was going to ask why Terry and Jody weren't getting on.
Who knows, man? Think I pay attention to crap like that? It was just some shit Chuck said while we were freezing our asses off in the van waiting for you to show. It wouldn't surprise me if they weren't so hot for each other now. One of them lost her job and the other one kept it. Envy, that's what that's called.
I stood up. Thanks, I said. I appreciate the information. Pace got up too and put out his hand. I shook it.
Oh yeah, he said. I'm happy to help a guy that lets me know I'll be catching lead as soon as he comes through the door.
Well, I didn't exactly think you were reaching for a number two pencil.
You got that right, Reardon. Watch your back now.
I went out the trailer door. The salesman and the couple I'd seen earlier were just coming up the steps. I left the door open and the salesman slipped through behind me.
Dale, I've got some bad news, he said in a loud voice from inside. The Hendersons here have just about stolen a car from us.
I flagged a cab on Market and rode back to my apartment. I tried calling Jody at Bishop's mansion, but I got the answering machine twice, and the third time Bishop himself picked up, and I had no intention of talking to him. Just for yucks, I tried the number from Nagel's phone bill. It didn't pick up at all. I thought about calling Margaret Teller, but I wasn't sure what I would say to her. I wondered what made me think of her at all. When I got bored asking myself questions I couldn't answer, I took a long hot shower and changed for my gig at Enducci. At around 6 o'clock, I carried my electric bass and amp down to the Galaxy 500. The first drops from some nasty-looking storm clouds flattened against my windshield as I rolled down Post Street. Chapter 24. Checked. The gig went well. Tony Rulin's group, Zugzwan, was cut a little too much in the pattern of fusion groups like the Yellow Jackets to suit my reactionary tastes, but I enjoyed having the opportunity to do some slap plucking, and Tony gave me a good lead on a replacement for my string bass. I got home about 1:30, too wired to go to bed. I was drinking bourbon and listening to Zoot Sims' 1952 recording, Zoot Case, when the phone rang. I uncoiled from the couch and walked over to the phone. I had a sudden feeling of edgy apprehension, like I'd seen a violent flash of lightning and was bracing for the accompanying clap of thunder. The display for my caller ID showed the person phoning had blocked his line, which only added to my misgivings. I picked up the phone and put the receiver to my ear without saying anything. It was a cell phone connection, but apart from static, nothing came through, not even breathing. I waited for what seemed like a very long time, gripping the phone tightly, staring at my shoes, and finally I gave in. I said, "You never let me get a word in edgewise." A voice came on, deep and somewhat muffled. It seemed familiar and then it didn't. "Package for you, Reardon. Hotel Cavalier on Eddie at Taylor. Room 312. It's perishable goods, so snap it up." The line switched off with a metallic snarl. I put the phone down and massaged the back of my neck. Eddie at Taylor was the heart of the Tenderloin. I could imagine few places worse to go running off to in the middle of the night. The only good thing about it was that it was convenient. Given the marginal placement of my own apartment, the Hotel Cavalier would be only about 6 blocks south and east. For no good reason that I could see, I decided to go. I went to the closet and got out my raincoat. I shrugged that on and then yanked the Glock from its holster and dumped it in a pocket. I felt undergunned, or more accurately, just plain scared. So I pulled the lockbox from underneath my bed and took out my Smith & Wesson 38 revolver. That went in the other pocket. It didn't help much with being scared, but at least I wasn't lopsided. I put on a beat-up fedora and left. Outside, storm clouds still spat rain and my breath billowed in front of me as I walked up Hyde. In a strange form of natural selection, the character of the neighborhood changed the further I got in the Tenderloin. It went from a broad mix of shops, restaurants, bars, and apartment houses to the marginalized amalgam of sleazy adult bookstores, massage parlors, residence hotels, and fly-by-night auto repair shops that was better adapted for survival. Few people were out and about, but there were plenty of bodies curled up in doorways, covered in blankets if they were fortunate, or cardboard or newspapers if they were not. When I got to Eddie, I took a left and continued on past Leavenworth and Jones. Partway down the block between Jones and Taylor was a tiny city park. Notorious for drug and prostitution traffic during the day, even now there were groups of people huddled under trees, smoking cigarettes, and taking pulls from bottles wrapped in brown paper. One of the city's new pay toilets stood at the perimeter near the street. The toilets had been acquired from a company in France, were self-cleaning, and were supposed to solve the problem of public facilities in San Francisco as they had in Paris, with economy, decorum, and Gallic je ne sais quoi. As I walked by, the door to the green, oval-shaped structure lurched open, and out tumbled a middle-aged black man with his pants around his ankles. He hit the ground with a heavy grunt, and the bottle he was holding slipped from his grasp and rolled past me into the gutter. Somebody in the park yelled, "Yo, Jerome! Your bottle or your pants? You best be holding on to one of them." Stifled laughter followed. I detoured around the man and crossed the street to where I could see the words Hotel Cavalier written in a faded script on a dingy, narrow building sandwiched between a head shop and an adult bookstore. A metal grating covered the entryway to the building, but the door to the grating stood wide open. Likewise, the front door itself was ajar. All this seemed a little too convenient. I put my right hand in my raincoat and took firm hold of the automatic, snicking off the safety with my thumb. Then I stepped inside. There was a minuscule lobby lit by a dusty Art Deco chandelier that had spots for 5 bulbs with 2 missing and 1 burned out. A threadbare carpet stretched tight over too much rubbery padding covered the floor. It was like walking on a spun sausage. To the right was a barred window with a narrow counter looking into an office. No light came from the office, and no one was sitting at the desk inside. A staircase with a carved oak banister and a solid streak of black grime running along the wall at waist level opened in front of me. I crept up the stair, staying close to the banister so I might be harder to spot from above. The second floor landing had a tile floor with dust balls the size of hen's eggs, cluttered with a ruined bicycle and a rusted folding cot that wouldn't have opened if you'd used a hydraulic jack. A quick check confirmed the rooms on the corridor were numbered in the 200s, so I continued up the stairs. Thus far, I'd seen no one and heard nothing, not even a muted TV. The third floor landing was as cluttered as the last, with the added attraction of floor tiles chipped out of the grout. I went down the hallway on spongy carpet, watching the even-numbered rooms on the right. 312 was next to a busted ice machine filled with empty Chinese food containers, dead soldiers from the Mogad David platoon, and a savory scattering of used condoms. I saw light coming from the bottom of the door at 312 as I tapped on it with the butt of my automatic. There was no response. I cleared my throat to speak. It seemed like I hadn't talked since I last changed the shelf paper in my kitchen. "Open up," I said. "The fall guy is here." Still nothing from inside. In true fall guy fashion, I took hold of the doorknob and twisted. It wasn't locked, but then it wouldn't be. I gave the door a shove and jumped to one side, dodging the spread of buckshot I knew to be coming. None obliged me by coming. The door hit the interior wall with a crash and rebounded part of the way back. I pushed the automatic across the threshold and craned my neck around the doorframe to see into the room. Terry McCullough was sprawled face down on a bare mattress in a cheap iron bed frame. One arm flopped over the side like she was trailing her hand in the wake of a canoe. On the floor, a few inches from her outstretched fingers, was a hypodermic syringe. Her face was flattened against the mattress, and the flow of saliva from her gaping mouth had darkened the fabric in an irregular stain. Her hair was a tangled mop, the tips of it damp with sweat or rain. She wore black panties and black socks and nothing else. I swept into the room and searched it, still wary of being jumped from behind. No one was in the bedroom or in the closet, and the revolting little bath was home only to fat, shiny roaches. I closed and bolted the room door and went to the woman on the bed. The pulse in Terry McCullough's neck throbbed when I touched it, but it seemed very slow and irregular. Lying next to her was a leather purse as big as a knapsack, and next to that was a number of items that had spilled from it. One of these was a spoon with a blackened bottom, and a handle bent in a flat ring. A crust of brown scales adhered to the bowl, residue from the heroin Terry McCullough had shot into her veins. Of more immediate utility was a cell phone, very possibly the one used to call me. Without bothering about fingerprints, I grabbed the phone from the bed and dialed 911. I told the emergency operator to send an ambulance to the hotel for a drug overdose victim. She asked me to stay on the line so she could collect more information, but I told her there wasn't any and hung up. I shook the remaining contents of her purse onto the bed. Terry's pearl-handled automatic, a disposable lighter, some currency, and several white packages that looked like drugs fell out. The last thing to come cartwheeling down was a fat card about 2 inches by 3. I retrieved it from the side of Terry's leg where it had landed. It had the letters PCMICA printed on it, along with flash memory card and 1 gigabyte. I didn't know much about electronics, but this had to be some kind of computer media. I slipped it into my hip pocket behind my wallet, and then pushed the rest of the stuff back into the purse, covering my hand with the material for my raincoat so as not to leave prints. I looked down at Terry McCullough. I wondered if there was anything I could do before the paramedics arrived. She hadn't ingested the heroin, so there was no point in trying to make her throw up. I could try slapping her and marching her around the room, but I suspected that was only done in Hollywood movies to make with a dramatic scene. I settled on flipping her over so that she might breathe easier. She made a blubbering noise as I turned her, and I noticed for the first time that her left arm, which had been hidden under the body, had a rubber tube tied around it. A puncture mark was visible above the tube on top of a distended vein. I pulled off the tubing and covered her with my raincoat, as much to keep her praying mantis tattoo and pierced nipples from my view as to keep her warm. I spent the next few minutes pacing back and forth in front of the bed, pausing occasionally to check to see if she was still breathing. A heavy pounding on the door put an end to that.
"Did somebody here call for an ambulance?" yelled a voice in a faint Irish brogue.
I unlocked the door and pulled it open. Standing in the hallway was a stocky paramedic with red hair, a florid complexion, and freckled horse teeth. It was my friend Ronan O'Grady. Behind him was another uniformed paramedic, a bulky woman with shoulder-length black hair, no makeup, and a butt big enough to smother a grizzly.
"God's teeth," said O'Grady.
"What are you doing here?"
"If we had 2 hours, I could tell you. Your meat's over there, and she's not looking any too good." O'Grady swaggered through the door like Marshall Dillon and went over to the bed. His partner manhandled a gurney in from the hallway. O'Grady picked up Terry McCullough's limp arm to check her pulse, and then got a small flash from his belt to shine in her pupil.
"Sure, it's as bad as you could wish for," hissed O'Grady.
His eyes strayed to the syringe where it still lay on the floor.
"It's heroin, is it then?"
"Yeah, the spoon she used is on the bed." The female paramedic was rummaging through a medical bag on top of the gurney. She pulled out a syringe of her own and passed it over to O'Grady without being asked. O'Grady found a choice vein in Terry McCullough's right arm and plunged the hypodermic home. He yanked the raincoat off her and roughly maneuvered her arms to the center of her torso.
"Come on," he said to me. "Take her feet and we'll swing her onto the stretcher."
As we hefted her off the bed, the silver rings on her nipples flashed in the thin light from the ceiling fixture. Bent between us like a deflated air mattress, she looked weak, pale, and feverish. We placed her down carefully in the white sheets, and O'Grady's partner pulled a blanket over her and buckled 2 nylon straps across her body.
"Right," said O'Grady. "Let's roll."
"What about the IV?" asked the woman.
"Fuck the IV. We'll start it once we get her in the wagon. Now move."
The two of them maneuvered the gurney out the door and into the hallway. As they raced towards the stairwell, I yelled at their backs.
"Can I ride with you to the hospital?"
"No,"
said O'Grady, lifting the gurney to start down the stairs.
"You have to wait for the cops."
"My favorite thing," I said, but they had already gone out of view. A door across the corridor opened and out stepped a sleepy old geezer in a t-shirt and boxer shorts. His hair stood up like dead weeds, and he'd left his teeth soaking in the glass.
"What's going on?"
he asked. "Drug overdose," I said. "You know the party in this room?"
"Yeah, I seen her."
His words were slurred without dentures.
"She can even make my old pecker snap, too."
"Great. Something to look forward to in my golden years. You see anybody else go in or out of this room tonight?" The old guy scratched his crotch thoughtfully.
"Thought I might have heard someone a while ago, but I didn't get up to check. There's always some damn thing going on around here."
I heard the tromp of feet on the stairs, and the old guy and I turned to see the hats of 2 uniformed officers rise over the banister. The old man said,
"Better you than me, son,"
and ducked back into his room. I stood my ground in the corridor as the cops approached. As it turned out, they were like scout ants sent to find food at a picnic. They were quickly joined by 2 more patrol cops, and after I explained that the woman who OD'd was Terry McCullough, chief suspect in the Roland Tiller murder, There were soon plainclothes officers, lab technicians, and eventually a chief of detectives. They cordoned off the room, took photographs, collected samples of the heroin, dusted for prints, interviewed people on the hotel corridor, and most of all, grilled the heck out of me. By 4 a.m., I'd been taken down to headquarters, and my story of being alerted to Terry McCullough's whereabouts by a mysterious phone caller was being received by fresh skepticism by an entirely new set of faces. Somewhere along the way, I got permission to make a phone call myself, and I used the privilege to leave a message for Stockwell at his office. At the very least, I owed him a personal call, and in any case, I didn't trust the San Francisco cops to get the story to him promptly. When dawn came, I was sitting in an interrogation room by myself with my head cupped in my palm and a styrofoam cup of coffee on the table in front of me. Without non-dairy creamer, it tasted like lukewarm tobacco spit. With it, lukewarm tobacco spit and flea powder. I amused myself by stirring the coffee and watching the undissolved creamer flakes swirl around like stars in a muddy little galaxy. Eventually, I must have nodded off. The next thing I knew, a rough hand was shaking me by the shoulder. "You're free to go, Reardon," said a voice. I looked up and found a weathered cop with gray hair combed straight back standing over me. He had suspicious eyes, and if he knew how to smile, it would only be from reading about it. I stood up wearily and slung my raincoat over my shoulder. I walked to the door of the interrogation room and pulled on the knob. "By the way," said the cop behind me, "Terry McCullough died this morning at 4:36. Heart just stopped. Nothing they could do."
You have been listening to The Immortal Game, a San Francisco Chronicle book of the year. You can find it in ebook and trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Hear more at patreon.com/markcoggins or author website markcoggins.com.